This episode of Cocaine and Rhinestones is the second episode in a three-part series on Harper Valley PTA. If this is the first episode of the podcast you are listening to, I would recommend going back and at least listening to last week's episode before this one, even if you're just a huge Jeannie C. Reilly fan and you don't even know who Shelby Singleton is. If you haven't heard last week's episode, you'll be missing out on a lot of context, and I'm not going to be doing very much recapping. Last week, we spent some time looking at how far outside of the box Shelby Singleton was willing to go for a hit song. Now, are we sure we know what a hit song is? How to define it? It's safe to say any song that hits the top 10 could be called a hit, right? Okay, this past May, when I began working on this podcast, I spent about a week listening to every song to ever go number one on the Billboard Country Chart, in chronological order from the first year the chart existed in 1944 until this show's cutoff point in the year 2000. I needed to make sure I'd heard them all to build a timeline of what happened in the mainstream of country music in the 1900s. There were quite a few songs I'd never heard before. Unless you've purposefully sat down to give yourself the same experience, or spent the past 70-something years of your life glued to country radio, the same thing is true for you. Number one songs, hit songs, completely absent from our personal experience of country music. Even when the song at number one the week before or the week after is one of our favorite songs of all time. Now imagine how many top 10 hits between 1944 and the year 2000 we haven't heard. Probably hundreds of hit country songs you've never heard in your life, I've never heard in my life. So we can say, all hits are not created equal. Not in the mind of the audience, and definitely not in the mind of the record industry. I should give a disclaimer here that commercial success is obviously not everything. Obviously not a gauge of artistic merit. There are brilliant country artists who've never had a hit in their lives. That's not what we're talking about today. But if we're saying top 10 singles are hits, and I believe we should say that, then just having hits wasn't enough for this industry. You had to have more hits, bigger hits. It was called the record industry. Move units, make money, or get out of the way for the next artist who will. Always be scaling up. Anything that isn't as good as or better than the last thing you did, you might as well have not done it, and you'll probably end up wishing you hadn't. I think the worst thing that could happen to a country recording artist in this climate is for their very first single to become a number one hit. You can't do any better than that. The only way to improve on that is to stay number one for more weeks, sell more copies. Even if you manage to do that, it's only a matter of time until you put out a song that only goes to number two or number five. But that's still a hit. Oh, sure it is. Or maybe it's the beginning of the end. Maybe you just don't have the stuff anymore, kiddo. We gotta get those numbers back up to where they were, or well, it ain't gonna be good. Imagine you're a new country artist and your very first single goes number one country and pop. How screwed do you think you are? There aren't many people you can ask about this. Billy Swan is one. Jeannie C. Reilly, the singer of Harper Valley PTA, is the other one. Those are the only two people alive who've had their first single go number one country and pop. Neither one of them ever had another number one song. I've heard them both called one-hit wonders. Billy Swan never even got back in the top 10. Although he did also write his one hit, I Can Help, and Elvis Presley recorded that, so I assume Billy's doing fine. If you got a problem, don't care what it is. If you need a hand, I can assure you this, I can help. I got two strong arms, I can help. It would sure do me good. Jeannie C. Reilly put out five more top 10 hits, four of which crossed over into the Billboard Hot 100. These are country songs, by the way. None of that stripped down Nashville sound stuff the industry bent over backwards to push at pop audiences. Jeannie was achieving crossover success with one of the most unsophisticated Texas twangs you've ever heard, and a hardcore country sound behind it. That's not what one-hit wonders do.
'Cause if I'm good enough to be your woman, good enough to share your life, good enough to live together, I'm good enough to be your wife, good enough to have your children, good enough to give them life, good enough to do your cooking, I'm good enough to be your wife.
But because her first single sold maybe 6 million records, nothing she did after that mattered. Jeannie Carolyn Stevenson was born in a small Texas town in 1945. In 1962, while still a senior in high school, she married her boyfriend, Mickey Riley, and became Jeannie Carolyn Riley. So C stands for Carolyn. Her uncle was a country guitar player and songwriter. Nobody you'd know, but in the tiny town of Anson, Texas, just the fact that he'd gone to Nashville to record in a real studio was a big deal. Or at least Jeannie seems to think people thought so. Her husband Mickey knew it was Jeannie's dream to move to Nashville and become a famous singer. He was supportive of that. But they decided to wait until Jeannie finished high school and save some money for the move. Then Jeannie found out she was pregnant and they had a baby. In 1966. Yes, that is 4 years after they got married, and unless it took Jeannie 4 years to pass 12th grade, the math doesn't add up at all for her to use the baby as an excuse for why they stayed in Texas. I'll get to it in a second. One day, Jeannie says, she gets a letter from the great pedal steel player, Weldon Myrick, who'd seen her sing at a local jamboree and just had to write her to say that he thought of Jeannie singing every time he heard Connie Smith sing Once a Day.
The only time I wish you weren't gone is once a day, every day, all day long.
Now, in just a minute, you may decide Jeannie's making this part up, but it is possible that it's true. Later, you'll hear she was able to sing in a somewhat similar style to Connie Smith. So Weldon's letter gives her a little encouragement. The next time Uncle Johnny goes to Nashville, he invites the entire family on the trip, and they go. Still in 1966 here, 13 people pile into 2 cars to make the trip. Up in Nashville, they drive around Lower Broadway to look at Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, Ernest Tubb's Record Shop, and the Ryman Auditorium. All that country music tourist stuff. Uncle Johnny gets them backstage at the Grand Ole Opry, and Jeannie's all starstruck. She gets an autograph from Connie Smith. Jackie Phelps, the guy you'd later see playing guitar on Hee Haw, takes Uncle Johnny aside to give him some advice. "Your little niece is a pretty country girl, and I'd like to save her and her husband some heartache. If she's got talent, tell her she doesn't have to sell her body to make it to the top. She can make it if she knows the right people. But if she gets in with the wrong crowd, they'll destroy her and her home too." You're listening to Cocaine and Rhinestones, the podcast about 20th century country music and the lies of those who gave it to us. My name is Tyler Mahan Coe. I've heard these stories my whole life, as far as I can tell. Okay, freeze. Jeannie C. Riley's autobiography is really the only source I can use for this stuff, and it's super sketchy to say the least. This is the first of several outlandish scenarios where famous people give her incredibly personal advice that is also so extremely specific, it's almost as if they can see into Jeannie's actual future mere moments after meeting her for the very first time. You're a professional musician. A colleague of yours brings his niece to see a show. You take it upon yourself to call the guy aside and tell him to make sure to let his niece know not to be a hooker. Not likely. Jeannie does go on to find herself in some bad situations, and I don't doubt for a second that they really happened. But believing her about that does not mean I have to believe everything else she says. There's all these run-ins with celebrities who seem to have psychic powers. The timeline she presents often makes no sense. Fine, but at least one major part of her story is deliberately misrepresented. She is blatantly lying about certain things. There's even a note at the beginning of the book about how several names and some details have been changed to protect people, blah, blah, blah. Basically, it could not be more clear that this autobiography is more like what you'd call an autohagiography, the Hollywood movie version of these events. They might as well have printed based on a true story on the title page. I should say, this is one of those celebrity autobiographies that's written with the help of an author, so, you know, it's possible this guy had a hand in these embellishments. You can make up your own mind, that's what I'll say, but this is gonna get real crazy, so just please try to remember this. Here's an example of a small type of thing that I probably wouldn't even mention if I only noticed it once or twice. The book opens with her locking up the office building in Nashville where she worked as a secretary, walking over to a recording studio, and being greeted by Shelby Singleton handing her the lyrics of Harbor Valley PTA. We've got Shelby saying, "It's just right for your voice. Tom Hall has caught the angry mood of the country. Let's see if you can make it sing." The problem is, as you'll hear in a few minutes, the entire week before this, Jeannie had been arguing with everyone about not liking this song and whether or not it would be released under her own name or a pseudonym. In the very next paragraph, she says she'd already studied the lyrics, which she would have gotten from Shelby. Why does she have Shelby presenting the lyrics to her here with such pomp, as if for the very first time, as if she's never heard this song before? Like I said, small thing, I would let it slide, but this is a death by a thousand cuts situation. There's at least one scene where two people go back and forth with lines of quoted dialogue in a conversation that Jeannie was not there for and could not possibly remember with such detail, even if she was blessed with total recall over a decade after the fact. There's one more scene where she's driving her car while upset, quote, half blind from the tears. She accidentally speeds over some railroad tracks just ahead of a crossing train, and I'm quoting here. "The train loomed over me as I roared across the tracks, missing my back bumper by less than a foot. The vacuum created by the rushing locomotive and the rumbling wheels almost flipped my car over. The screeching, half blind from tears, yet she knows within a 12-inch margin of error how close a train passed to the back bumper of her car." So that's what I'm working with here, and whatever, you'll see. Okay, we're still in Nashville, the night Jeannie's uncle takes her backstage at the Opry. When they leave the Opry that night, Doyle Wilburn of the Wilburn Brothers has agreed to listen to Jeannie sing if they'll come by the office of Surefire, his publishing company. A few days later, they drop into the Surefire office and meet Johnny Russell, who is a staff songwriter there. Johnny Russell listens to her sing. They decide to have her go in the studio that night and the next to record a 4-song demo tape. They have a photographer take some pictures of her. Jeannie thinks all of this means she's on her way to becoming a star. The second night of recording, within 48 hours of meeting her, Johnny Russell pulls Jeannie and her husband Mickey aside to tell them, quote, "I've watched you kids ever since you got here, and I need to say something to you. Nashville is good to you when you're on top, but it's a mean city too. This business of wanting to be number one gets in your blood. It consumes you until you can't think of anything else. It's like drugs, only worse, because there's nothing you can do to get rid of it. You'll leave your family. You'll leave your self-respect. You'll do anything to reach the top, and anything to stay there. I've seen it happen too many times. Most people think they are the exception. They come in here with high morals and high ideals and lose them overnight. The pressures are too much. What I'm saying is this. I don't think Jeannie can make it here. She's got a good voice and you're a fine young couple. But this city will chew you up, swallow the juice, and spit you out like a dry hull on the street. Go back to Texas and stay there." Wow, that is one hell of a monologue, huh? I don't know how anyone gets anything done in the music business when they're delivering fully polished 150-word speeches like that to everyone they've known for 48 hours. Anyway, after a week or so, the Texas crew heads back to Texas. Doyle Wilburn had told them the Wilburns would be needing a female vocalist for their upcoming September tour of Germany. Jeannie should expect their call. All through July, she expects the call. All through August, she expects the call. Of course, it never comes, so she gets all bummed out until Mickey comes home from work one day and tells her to start packing. He's sick of seeing her mope around the house. They're moving to Nashville. As they cross the city limit sign into Nashville, she and Mickey make a pact that they'll always travel together as a family, the baby too. Quote, Show business might chew up other folks and spit them onto the sidewalk, but not us. We'd show them. We were gonna make it. Together. This is the end of 1966. Because of everyone Jeannie starts having sex with, and the fact that she changes their names and the names of the companies they work for, it gets really confusing to work out the specifics of what happens when and where for the next year. For instance, she refers to her first manager, Paul Perry, as Pete Terry through her entire book because of the affair she later has with him. This other guy gets named Phil Blackman, and he's a big shot at Black Rose Records, based out of New York. Phil Blackman is our big bad wolf. Uncle Johnny bought a gas station right before Jeannie and Mickey moved to Nashville. So that's where Mickey starts working. They live in a motel room, then a small apartment. Jeannie keeps calling Surefire Music to find out why they didn't hire her for that Wilburn Brothers tour. She eventually finds out that tour was canceled and then gets to work furthering her career by checking the mailbox and waiting for the phone to ring. She writes that she spends weeks waiting for the world to notice her, resenting her husband for working 12-hour days at a gas station to support her and the baby, while also begging him to move them to a bigger apartment closer to his work. One day, she finally realizes she's gonna have to actually try to get people to care that she exists. She gets all dolled up and drives with her baby down to Music Row to look for this powerful woman she'd heard of who was from a town in Texas, 25 miles away from where Jeannie was from. She apparently thinks she can meet this lady, say, "Hey, I'm from Texas too," and get a record deal or something. She has no idea where this lady's office is supposed to be. She just starts walking into publishing companies to find out if that lady works there or not. When some kid asks if she's trying to get a demo tape heard, Jeannie pulls out her tape and the kid takes a listen. He seems to like it, plays it for his boss, who says it sounds too much like Loretta Lynn, and they tell Jeannie to kick rocks. She goes back to her car with the baby and cries, then decides to drive over to the gas station where Mickey works. When she gets there, Mickey's talking to a guy named Jerry Chestnut, a rich guy who owns a vacuum cleaner business but also wants to be a songwriter. You've heard the song he'd write a few years after this called A Good Year for the Roses.
When you turn to walk away, as the door behind you closes, the only thing I know to say, it's been a good year for the roses.
Mickey has a copy of Jeannie's demo tape that he plays in the gas station just in case someone important happens to come in and hear it and care. Chestnut isn't really important yet, but he did strike up a conversation and offer to play the demo tape for his friends at Monument Records. A few days later, he calls to say Monument is interested, but they want to change Jeannie's name because they're already doing well with Jeannie Seeley. And let's not get carried away with the Jeannies over here, right? Our Jeannie's not thrilled about this, but Jerry thinks they can get Monument to back off the name change if they stay on it. Jeannie gets shown off at a DJ convention, introduced to everyone in town as Tina Stevens, the next girl they're gonna sign and do big things with. But then she gets forgotten about because apparently a major female artist on the label doesn't like Jeannie, or Tina, or whoever. Back to square one. Jerry Chestnut meets a radio DJ named Paul Perry, who knows Phil Blackman, a made-up name for a real important guy at Black Rose, which is also a made-up name for a real record label. Remember this sentence. That DJ Paul Perry sends Jeannie's demo and a promo picture to Phil Blackman in New York City. Blackman expresses interest in recording Jeannie when he comes to Nashville sometime in January. It ends up being early February of 1967 when Jeannie walks in to Black Rose's office for the first time. She writes literally nothing about the conversation, only that she finds Phil Blackman very attractive and she leaves with a contract. That night, she begins fantasizing that Blackman will fall in love with her. Within a week, in reality, they've kissed. Blackman goes back to New York City for business. When he returns a few weeks later, he and Jeannie start having a full-fledged affair. Now, I don't like dwelling on this soap opera stuff unless the story cannot be told without it. So here's the relevant information. That DJ named Paul Perry becomes Jeannie's first manager. She technically gets a single released on Black Rose Records, but it's only technically released. No money is put into promoting it, and not even Jeannie thinks it's any good. But she does think she and this rich, powerful man are in love with each other, so she's not too worried about that record. Then, one day in Blackman's apartment, Jeannie's laying naked on the couch after having sex with him when she's suddenly blinded by flashes of bright light. There's Blackman holding a camera with a strobe flash attachment. Jeannie freaks out. He tells her there's no film in the camera. She asks if he really loves her. He laughs at her, says mean things to her about how stupid she is, and she leaves crying. Fast forward to 6 months later. It's early in the fall of 1967. Jeannie's in Las Vegas for a week as Johnny Paycheck's opener. Paycheck is on his way up after having his first top 10 hit the year before with The Lovin' Machine.
So I drove around the corner, up the street and down the highway, showing off to everybody that I've seen. She's a streamlined, sleek-looking, smooth-running, fast-moving, breathtaking, loving machine.
Phil Blackman is also in Las Vegas, but Jeannie manages to resist his advances. Fast forward again to January of 1968. Jeannie gets Blackman to release her from her contract so she can go record for Little Darlin' Records. This is the record label started by Johnny Paycheck and his producer, Aubrey Mayhew, who had heard Jeannie sing in Vegas and decided he'd like to record her. Aubrey does record her. A single is released on Little Darlin', but like the Black Rose single with Phil Blackman, it's only technically released, not really promoted, because they, quote, wound up in contract difficulties. I will come back to this. Meanwhile, Jerry Chestnut has decided to get out of the vacuum cleaner business and all the way into the music business, opening up a Music Row office for his publishing company. He hires Jeannie as a secretary, which is where she's working when a songwriter friend asks her to sing on the demo of his new song he wants Shelby Singleton at Plantation Records to hear. I couldn't find a recording of Jeannie singing it, but I found the songwriter singing it himself, so you can try to imagine what Jeannie would have sounded like on the demo. Clark Bentley's Old Town Drunk comes out on Plantation Records in 1968.
Nobody missed the Old Town Drunk until they thought he was gone. They remember his good ways, the little favors he's done. They all say he was a good old boy. Nobody misses anyone until they think they're gone.
When Shelby hears the demo, he's more interested in the voice of the singer than the song. If you listen to last week's episode, this is the part where he wants to meet that singer to see if she's got the image he's looking for to sing Harper Valley PTA. Here on Jeannie's side, she wants to listen to Harper Valley PTA before she agrees to anything. Her manager, Paul Perry, thinks she's crazy for not getting on board, sight unseen, but he brings her a tape. She doesn't like the song. Just doesn't like something about it. Says it sounds like a soft redo of Ode to Billy Joe. Now Paul Perry and all her friends think she's crazy. She agrees to meet with Shelby, and there's something she doesn't like about him, too. Shelby tells her they can make a pop hit together, but they'll have to change her name because there's too many Jeannies in Nashville. Same old story. He wants to call her Rhonda Renee. She's thinking about that when Perry says if Jeannie doesn't take this deal, then he can't represent her anymore. It's not gonna get any better than this. She signs the papers, goes home, and cries about it. Her husband Mickey comes home to find her upset, hears the story about them wanting to change her name, calls Paul Perry and yells at him to tear up the contract. Jeannie's not doing it. The next day, all the business people convince her they'll let her keep her own name if she just comes in on Friday after work to record this damn song. The entire day Friday, Jeannie's pissed off at the world. She feels like she's being backed into a corner and talked into doing something she doesn't want to do. On top of that, she's sure everyone's lying to her about getting to use her real name. Still, she goes to the studio, channels her anger into the song, and nails it on the second take.
And then you have the nerve to tell me you think that as a mother I'm not fit. Well, this is just a little Peyton place and you're all Harper Valley hypocrites. No, I wouldn't put you on because it really did. It happened just this way.
Shelby tells Jeannie they'll use her middle initial to make her stand out more from the other Jeannies and add an I to her first name so people know it's not pronounced Jean. Finding out she really doesn't have to be Rhonda Renee, plus the fact that everyone in the room seems certain she just cut a massive hit song, improves Jeannie's mood. She calls her mother at 1 in the morning to tell her she just recorded a song that's gonna be the number one song in the country. The masters are mixed and sent to the pressing plant on Saturday morning. Jeannie spends Monday handwriting hundreds of personalized notes to go with promo copies to DJs all over America. Anytime she comes to her own name or the name of the song, she switches from black ink to red so it stands out on the page. A station in Ohio plays the single 26 times in one day. Other stations ban it because they don't like her uppity tone. Love it or hate it, everyone talks about it. According to Jeannie, she and Mickey take a copy over to Ralph Emery at WSM. This doesn't necessarily conflict with Jerry Kennedy's story about Shelby taking over an acetate the night of the session. Jeannie would want Ralph to have a real copy of the record. But then Jeannie says Ralph tells Mickey, "Y'all be really careful, so many families break up as soon as the singer hits the big time." The next Friday, they're in Philadelphia for Jeannie to sing her song on TV. Saturday, New York City. Jeannie's with Mickey, Paul Perry, and his wife, Shelby, and a dozen other business people from Nashville. A real entourage. They stay in nice hotels, drink champagne, order room service, and leave huge tips at dinners. Jeannie doesn't realize how all this works until later, when she finds out she's the one paying for all of that. Jeannie and Mickey don't need help spending the money. They're throwing down major cash on clothing, jewelry, hairstyles, cars, all the usual rock star stuff. A week after New York, they're in Florida doing a show with Waylon Jennings. Out of nowhere, Waylon tells Jeannie that she won't stay married to Mickey for long because he just don't fit the scene. If you ever need to find out exactly what's wrong with your life, all you have to do is go stand by a country musician for a few minutes. They're all psychic and chomping at the bit to give you advice. Anyway, pretty soon Jeannie starts spending too much time with her manager, Paul Perry. One night, they're sitting around holding hands and Perry's talking about how careful Jeannie has to be now that she's on top. He sure hopes she doesn't have anything in her past that could come back to haunt her. You know, like nudie pictures taken by Phil Blackman. Back in Nashville, first thing Monday morning, Jeannie heads over to Black Rose Records. There's Blackman in his office, packing up a stack of brand new Jeannie C. Reilly records, made from her old sessions with him. Now that Jeannie's got the biggest hit in the nation, these records will sell. They argue. She demands the naked pictures. He plays stupid at first, but then says it'll take him a couple days to get them. Come back Wednesday. Skip to Wednesday. Blackman's got a manila envelope like you see in every movie about a private detective, and he wants to give it to Jeannie, but first she's gotta sign a new piece of paper saying she won't sue him for releasing her old recordings. See, he's legally allowed to do that, and she'll even get paid royalties and everything. It's just that he lost their original contract, so sign here and here, and you can have those pictures. Of course, she signs the thing. Then, without even looking in the manila envelope, she asks him to burn it, which he does in front of her. By the time she gets home, half an hour later, the news is reporting that Black Rose Records has filed a lawsuit against Harper Valley PTA's singer and record label for breach of contract. Okay, here's the thing. Phil Blackman and Aubrey Mayhew are, at least partially, the same person. You do remember Aubrey, right? Johnny Paycheck's producer that heard Jeannie sing in Vegas wanted to record her, and that's why she got Blackman to let her out of her contract in the first place. Yeah, that's all bullshit. Phil Blackman and Black Rose Records are not fake names for someone and something that happened before Jeannie got involved with Aubrey Mayhew and Little Darlin'. Jeannie tells the same story two different ways as a red herring. Black Rose Records is Little Darlin' Records, which is also the explanation for why Jeannie would be in Las Vegas opening up for Johnny Paycheck when all she's supposedly done is one barely released single for Black Rose Records. If you were to rewind this episode and listen to the part about how Phil Blackman came into Jeannie C. Reilly's life, you'd be listening to the story of how Aubrey Mayhew came into her life. You'd be listening to the story of how Jeannie C. Reilly came to be signed to Little Darlin' Records. I know this because it's described exactly the same way in court documents related to the lawsuit Jeannie just told us about. Quote, as to Little Darlin' Records, the amended and supplemental bill asserts that prior to the time complainant was incorporated, its president, Aubrey Mayhew, did business in New York, New York as an individual under the proprietary name of Little Darlin' Records. That his first knowledge of defendant Reilly was a letter addressed to him on the date of December 8, 1966 by Paul Perry, enclosing the tape and photo mentioned. There was no barely released Black Rose single before the barely released Little Darlin' single. There was one barely released single. The contract difficulties Jeannie mentions to explain why her Little Darlin' single suffered the same fate as her Black Rose single? That's this lawsuit. The court document sheds more light on this. In response to Mayhew's lawsuit, Jeannie tells the court that Mayhew was never convinced she had enough talent to succeed as a recording artist and did not undertake to produce any records of her voice for general distribution. In other words, Aubrey Mayhew didn't think Jeannie was that good of a singer. He was using her as little more than a session vocalist for demo tapes he needed done anyway, while letting her believe she was a real recording artist. Jeannie seems to think that one single was just him going through the motions to string her along, and she's probably right. Speaking very strictly, Harper Valley PTA is not her debut single, as I said it was in the intro of this episode. But her first single may never have been meant for an audience larger than her immediate circle of family and friends. Something physical for Jeannie to play pretend with to keep the whole charade going. It was called You Write the Music, credited to Gene Reilly, quote-unquote, released on Little Darlin' Records in 1967.
You can tell of the love we knew with some pretty melody. I'll tell how it all ended in that awful tragedy. And it will be the saddest song ever heard. You write the music, I'll write the words.
Aubrey's first mistake was signing Jeannie to a real recording contract, which stipulated that she be recorded 4 times a year, a stipulation not met by using her for demo sessions. His second mistake was releasing her from her contract on April 3rd of 1968, 4 months before she recorded Harper Valley PTA. Now, here are the two big questions I don't think I can or should even try to answer. Did Aubrey Mayhew and Jeannie C. Reilly have an affair? And did Aubrey Mayhew take naked photographs of Jeannie C. Reilly without her consent and then blackmail her? Technically, Jeannie has never alleged either of these things against Aubrey Mayhew. That was Phil Blackman. I'm gonna play it safe and point out that it's possible Phil Blackman is meant as an amalgamation of more than one person. I'm not in any way a professional investigator. All I did was read a bunch of publicly available information and match it to what Jeannie wrote in her book. As far as I can tell, I'm the first reader of Jeannie's autobiography who cared enough to take the time to look into this. Or at least I'm the first one to talk about it. Searching Jeannie and Aubrey's names together only brings up information about them having worked together and information about this lawsuit. But listen, even if Phil Blackman is 100% Aubrey Mayhew, and even if we choose to 100% believe everything Jeannie says about him, that still doesn't mean Aubrey Mayhew took those pictures. Jeannie says she had him burn the envelope without looking inside. She even brings up the possibility herself that the envelope could have been empty. It doesn't look like any pornographic photographs were mentioned in the courtroom at all. The case was ruled in favor of Shelby Singleton and Jeannie C. Reilly. Back in the business of promoting their hit single, Jeannie gets sent to charm school to learn how to walk, talk, and act on stage. Then she's sent on tour. Concerts, talk shows, radio shows, live TV appearances. Her hometown names a day in April Jeannie C. Reilly Day, and there's a big ceremony for that. She gets to pick Wild Mountain Berries with Glenn Campbell on TV.
We're picking wild mountain berries, yeah. That's our excuse every time. We've been busy making berries and picking wild mountain berries. I don't know what, I don't know if I can keep from letting it show.
Whoa, yeah.
What's our plan, Glenn? What's our plan?
Don't know.
You know they won't understand. Glenn, my hair is dripping wet
and my clothes wet.
And we didn't go swimming in a swimming hole.
Yeah, they won't leave us alone.
She gets to live her dream of performing on the Grand Ole Opry.
The girl from Harper Valley, Miss Jeannie C. Reilly.
Thank you.
I want to tell you all a story about a Harper Valley widowed wife.
But then she gets her first royalty check and finds out how much of the money being spent is hers. Basically all of it. She's always expected to hang out and be nice to industry people. One night, there's a scene with Mickey when a random suit at a party is too persistent in trying to get Jeannie to dance with him. Mickey grabs the guy's wrist and tells him to back off. Later, Shelby tells Jeannie that Mickey needs to stay home if he can't control himself, and Mickey is banished from the road. If you're starting to get the idea that Jeannie's always thought of as little more than a puppet for the people behind the scenes of her career, I would say that seems accurate. Now, aside from the song itself, the biggest impact Jeannie C. Reilly had on country music with Harper Valley PTA was in fashion. It seems ridiculous today, but in the late 60s, that line in the song about the single mother wearing miniskirts, that in itself was enough to make a lot of country music fans gasp and turn off the radio. And while the song is actually sung by the daughter character who doesn't dress that way, every time you see Jeannie C. Reilly, she looks like Mrs. Johnson. Her style, or more accurately, the style she was made to wear, would best be described as mod. Like Nancy Sinatra in her boots are made for walking phase, way before any other women in country music were dressing that way. We're talking miniskirts, go-go boots, and in October of 1968, the first year the CMA Awards were televised, a ridiculous dress.
I had designed myself a French Marie Antoinette that would layer after layer hit the ground in a beautiful, huge dress. And I went to pick my dress up, and it only had four or five little short layers that stopped just below panty line. I said, what is that? My dressmaker said, your producer said if you showed up in anything but a mini skirt, he'd have my job. Well, it didn't matter that I was paying for the dress.
The ruffles start halfway up her rib cage and poof way out like they would to make a bell shape down to the ground, but then it all just stops halfway down her thighs, showing off legs and high heel cowgirl boots.
Single of the year, Harper Valley PTA.
She looks like an ostrich.
Thank you so much. I really hadn't planned a speech. I'd just like to say that
God bless everybody that had anything to do with it. I love all of you. Special thanks to the CMA, my producer Shelby Singleton, manager Paul Perry. I love you all.
After seeing the dress, but before the show, she called Shelby Singleton to yell at him. In the middle of her tirade, after she tells him she's not Miss Harper Valley PTA, she's an artist. Shelby cuts her off to say, "You're not an artist, baby. You're a commodity. A mini-skirted, silver-booted commodity. Now be there early. We've got a show to rehearse." That's one exchange that I don't doubt for a second happened just like that. The rest of Jeannie's book is about her struggles with infidelity and conversion to religion. More people seem to have mystical psychic powers. Like after a divorce from Mickey, a random sales clerk in a department store somewhere stops Jeannie to say, "Your ex-husband still loves you. God wants you to go back to him." Bullshit like that. She tells the story of the first time she tries pot, having an intensely spiritual vision that sends her into a fugue state for close to 24 hours and sounds more like an ayahuasca trip than any weed I've ever smoked. From the nightmare she describes, you'd expect that to be the only time she ever toked up, but this video clip of Ralph Emery interviewing her seems to suggest otherwise.
"And we are the guests this afternoon of Mr. Shelby Singleton, who has 13 record labels, and I don't know how many publishing companies, and a little lady you're going to see shortly, Jeannie C. Riley, records for one of the Shelby Singleton labels, Plantation. Yeah, and she's just done her new NBC television show, Harper Valley, USA, Clarksville, Tennessee last night, Nashville today, and the Johnny Carson Tonight Show tomorrow night. And then you're going to come back to Nashville for the convention?"
"I wouldn't miss it."
"Are you tired?"
"Well, I'm not so tired. My head hurts. You see, I ran into the mirror on my bus while I go just full force, and I've got a knot right there."
"I can't beat that line."
So I want to get away from her autobiography for the rest of this episode and talk more about the music Jeannie made after her hit. Because that last sentence is pretty typical of the way people talk about Jeannie C. Riley's career. A reference to her hit as if she had only one. A one-hit wonder, if you will. While it's true she never took another song to number one on both pop and country charts, not many people have ever done that. The only other woman to do that in the 1900s is Dolly Parton with 9 to 5 in 1981, making Jeannie the first woman to ever do it. If you don't count the farce with Little Darlin' Records, which you should not, she's the only woman to do it with her debut single. It's so unfair to judge the rest of her output against that. That's like mocking a rookie basketball player for only breaking a world record one time. Jeannie's follow-up single to Harper Valley PTA was called The Girl Most Likely. Sticking with the formula, it's another song about prejudice in a small town. This time, it's the girl who everyone thought would be the first one to get in that special kind of trouble only a teenage girl can get in, only turns out it's the Miss Goody Two-Shoes of the town who gets knocked up by the town doctor's son instead.
"And I was little Miss Nothing, and they thought of me as the girl most likely. Judged by the way I look, not the way I am. Well, I guess it's true I look the part, but developing fast was not my fault. Didn't know my sex appeal showed through those made-over clothes and run-down shoes. Now the doctor's son is hiding."
It went to number 6 on the country chart and number 55 on the Billboard Hot 100. I would call that a hit song. After that, Aubrey Mayhew put out an album consisting of everything he had sung by Jeannie during her time with Little Darlin'. The album is called Sock Soul. I'm guessing in reference to the line in Harper Valley PTA about how Mrs. Johnson socked it to him. But this stuff was all recorded before anyone thought of Jeannie C. Riley as the loudest voice calling BS on American society, so none of the songs fit that album title or her image. The material is good, it's just in the same vein being mined by every other female voice in country music.
"There was a time to get down on my knees to you when
The Price I Pay to Stay barely cracked the country top 40. From there, her singles were hit or miss, if you judge them by commercial results. But even when she released a legitimate hit, nobody saw it that way because it wasn't another Harper Valley PTA. Her first proper single released after that Little Darlin' compilation of basically demo recordings was There Never Was a Time. Here's her doing it on the Johnny Cash Show.
You know, the Grammy is the award for excellence in the recording industry. And this next young lady was rewarded with that honor for her gold record of Harper Valley PTA. And I wish I could present her with another one for fine looks, because she sure is pretty. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Jeannie C. Riley.
Sleeping.